Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to The Tillage Podcast with the Irish Farmers Journal.
Hello everyone, it's Wednesday evening, the 18th of May 2022. I'm Stephen Robb and you're listening to the Tillage Podcast. The latest edition of the Irish Farmers Journal newspaper has just been sent to the printers, which means it's that time of the week again, where I'm joined by my colleagues Andy Doyle and Siobhan Walsh to run through your key tillage news stories of the week. Right guys, getting straight into it this week. Where have we been? What have we seen out and about? What's happening in the fields?
Stephen, I've been out and about a good deal over the last couple of weeks, and certainly if you look at everything from the road, it looks mighty. You can see a little bit of variability in winter barley, and a lot of people would put winter barley down as the most variable of the winter crops that are out there this year, partly because of visible unevenness in the way it's earing out, which is not uncommon and probably related a lot of the time either to density on the ground or to compaction. But the major reason that people would throw back at me is that there's a lot of dwarf virus. Whatever particular virus it is, it's probably a bit more awkward and difficult to say for us mere mortals. So there's certainly visible virus there, which has made crops look very ragged and uneven up to now. Once they head out, it tends to be less visible, but the problem is nonetheless likely to be there if it is anyway a type of a severe virus. Winter wheats, winter barley now, most of it is headed, and therefore final sprays are on or going on, depending on the crop. Winter wheats, as far as I can see, again have remained clean. Again, there's a bit of virus in them in parts of the country. Not everywhere by any manner of means, and not in every crop, but there are fields that are bad where the husbandry would appear to have been broadly similar between fields, and yet one of them has a lot of virus and another might have little or virtually none. But outside of that, you know, generally crops are very clean. The flag leaves kind of came out just almost in a flash with the growth rates that were there in some recent days. So that's T2 timing for winter wheat. Mm-hmm. Oats generally has remained clean as well. Flag leaf long out, oat crops now heading out to head it out, just depending on where you are in the country and the sowing date. So things are really moving on. Spring crops moving on and past into stem extension, certainly the earlier ones. I was in oats during the week in a field that hasn't always been a great field, but the crop of oats looks absolutely mighty in it. Little specks of mildew down in the crop, but it was going nowhere. I haven't been in spring wheat. Spring barley, the vast majority of what you look at from the road looks fantastic with the way the bulk came into the growth. But if you walk fields, you quickly discover that there's weak patches in fields where establishment was uneven at the very word go. Everything that I've seen was quite clean, as in very clean. An odd leaf kind of yellowed off, which might be a virus and might be something else. It's hard to say. But I know that, Siobhan, you were in fields where you had different problems during the week.
Yeah, I saw a net blotch on spring barley, Andy, and very early to see it. And I talked to you about it first, and I kind of thought this is isolated. But as I walked more spring barley, you know, I saw more net blotch, and it was on Planet as well, which, look, we were talking about earlier, adds up, because Planet is, I think it's a 5 for net blotch on the recommended list. So certainly very early to be seeing it, because in some fields it was quite heavy. Like, you know, there was a lot of it there. It was clearly visible. You didn't have to, you know, you didn't have to be an experienced crop walker to be able to spot it in a field. You know, it was there to anyone's eye to see. But look, in general, spring barley is very good. And like, the weekend was great for spraying. I think a lot of people got T1s on spring barley, certainly around my area. They got them out on spring barley at the weekend. I think every sprayer in the country must have been out on Saturday. It was great weather for spraying. But look, echoing what you were saying on winter barley, I think a lot of people, you know, if they hadn't noticed the virus before, they certainly noticed it while they were spraying their last spray on their winter barley, because they saw, you know, circular patches or whatever, or patches along the headland where the barley wasn't heading out as quick as the rest of the field. And, you know, they realised they had virus in their field. But look, crops, I think, in general, looking very well. Beans is a crop, I think, is you know, it's every time you look at beans there, you can nearly see them growing. And I think they look exceptionally well at the minute, spring beans. Overall, look, crops looking well.
Yeah, the beans have switched over to the nodule nitrogen, and they're showing for it very, very quickly. And yeah, That's fantastic. And very quickly, they'll move into the stage where the protein aid is worted alone, just for the scent that beans will add to the countryside and the attractiveness that they pose for bees, etc. Just on the net blotch, Siobhan, it's something that I've certainly seen before, again, only in an occasional field and a less occasional year. But, you know, I'd have seen net blotch at 2 to 3 leaf stage on crops in the past, and it got very aggressive very early on. Whether it's anything to do with a resistance strain, and I don't think it is, because, you know, 1 year later and you don't see it moving at all. But it's worth remembering that net blotch is kind of seen as the most worrying or troublesome disease of barley that has the potential to develop resistance, particularly to the modern fungicide families. And therefore, we have to be pretty careful to make sure that a crop that has a lot of it, that we hit it pretty hard, and certainly that we don't expose things like STHIs to it. Now, in the main, in the past, we've been able to hold it. You know, we had other triazoles in the past that were as good or better, but we have certainly been able to hold it. And the likes of the Strobs, particularly Comets and Modems, you know, they're stronger. Like, we should remember that just after Septoria developing resistance to the Strobs, they quickly discovered that net blotch had also developed resistance. But unlike the Septoria, which was universal across every active, the net blotch was actually active specific. And I know that Amistar was one of the ones that kind of was recognized as being made much less efficient relatively quickly, while the Modems, etc., that was kind of regarded as having maintained its efficacy. So let's hope that it is maintaining its efficacy for the few fields that might need it this year.
Yeah. And Andy, were you saying like some of those isolated net blotch cases could be down to the seed and maybe just to might be worthwhile looking into that maybe?
Yeah, look, it's always a question mark as to where it comes from. Because, you know, you'd automatically go and look for a dirty stubble, maybe a mintail field, a stubble where there was very poor incorporation, and in particular a field where there had been a lot of net blotch in the previous year. I think a more important thing to ask is what was on the stubble? Was there a lot of volunteers on the stubble? And was there net blotch on those volunteers, and were they ploughed down cleanly? Because even if they were ploughed down reasonably cleanly, active net blotch on a leaf that's decaying probably could make its way directly onto the foliage of the next crop. But I would also have to wonder always about seed. You know, if there's four or five crops of planet in a given area that have net blotch, could it have come from the seed? I'm certainly not saying that it did, but could it have come from there? Because again, it would be important to try and isolate problems back to causes, if it's at all possible, because we learn from things like that if we can do it. But don't just suffer in silence. If you know somebody else that has a problem, just try and compare notes on seed lots, etc. There may be absolutely nothing in that suggestion, I hasten to add.
Get the Irish Farmer's Journal delivered to your door every Thursday. Subscribe to our limited time home delivery subscription offer and get a Regatta Gilet worth €45 free. Go to www.farmersjournal.ie/subscribe for more.
Andy, I just want to draw your attention to something you mentioned in your management notes this week at the back of the paper. And it was around some growers will probably likely be considering their nitrogen application rates, particularly in winter wheat, in terms of top dressing, given where grain prices have gone. So those growers who might have decided to pull back a little bit this year might consider reversing that and giving the crop what it needs to really realise its yield potential. Is that the case, do you think?
Well, Stephen, I would certainly have been encouraging people in the early part of the season when we looked at the value of grain then relative to the cost of nitrogen then. And I would have said that there was great scope for people to pull back 10% on rate, probably more, but to pull it back to keep themselves safe. And a lot of people could pull back 10% right up to grud stage 31 into the stem extension phase and still have built the maximum yield potential in the crop. So that's the way, if people did that or if they applied more nitrogen. But if you manage your crop even with less nitrogen to generate the maximum yield potential, well, with prices now where they're gone to, which is kind of above 400 for dry wheat, knocking on the door of 400 for dry barley come harvest, or at least that's the price yesterday and not necessarily today. Mm-hmm. Where that's the case, you know, it will certainly pay to drive on those crops with another 40 to 60 kilos of nitrogen, a practice that I would always have recommended for wheat, but not necessarily for barley. You know, not for barley, because barley, we know, has the capacity early in the season to generate all of this surplus carbohydrate within the crop and nutrient within the crop, which it can use to fuel grain fill if necessary. It doesn't depend on growth during grain fill for grain fill. It has already produced the carbohydrate, etc., that it needs for grain fill, and it's been stored in leaves and stems, and therefore late nitrogens on barley, you know, it's very difficult ever to see where you would get a benefit from them. To some degree, the same is true on oats, even if we don't have all of the science to substantiate the same reason for it. You tend not to get big kicks out of oats late in the season. On wheat, on the other hand, we know that the upper leaves are so important for the filling of the grain, and being able to prolong them with more nitrogen, being able to feed them and make them more photosynthetically active through nitrogen and possibly even magnesium if it was going to be deficient, should have the capacity to hold more grains, hold more spikelets in the head, although that's pretty well fixed at this stage, but certainly to hold more grains in the spikelet and to fill those grains better. And both of those components of yield can contribute massively still to field yield in winter wheat. And that's why I would seriously suggest that I've always been an advocate of the tree splits on wheat for as a controlled application. But I am increasingly conscious of the fact that you need to know where you're going to get that nitrogen used up, because to put nitrogen on where it's not needed at this point in the year is running the risk of nitrogen loss from a tillage field. And that's something that we have to try and avoid or at least minimize.
Yeah. OK. All right, guys, look, we're going to leave it there and step away from the fields for just a moment. Siobhan, on the tillage pages this week, the two of us are writing about a visit to Flahavens down in Waterford, which we did a few weeks back. Give us a flavour of what's on the page and why did we do it?
Yeah, so went to Flavin's. I was like a child of Christmas going to Flavin's. I think you enjoyed going as well, Dean, but I was a bit overexcited. We went down, I suppose. Look, we profiled the business on the pages this week, but I really wanted to see Flavin's and show readers the type of business that's out there, you know, that's supporting the Irish tillage industry. Flavin's takes in about 25,000 tons of oats each year, and then all those oats are now Irish. So last year was the first year that they took in about 9,000 to 10,000 tons of organic oats, and last year all those oats were Irish. So they had been importing some organic oats just to fill the requirement. So you know, you're talking about 10,000 hectares of oats. And then, you know, they're providing tillage farmers with a premium market for their crop. They're producing, you know, a really sustainable product, and supporting, you know, local Irish jobs and supporting the tillage industry. Mm. And you know, really, we hear about the organic scheme and all these things. But like long before organics got fashionable, you know, in the last year or two, when the EU said we have to go such and such percentage organic, Flavin's were pushing organics. And you without Flavin's pushing organics for their products, realistically, the organic area wouldn't have grown as much as it has, because they were a business that were really championing it. And look, for a good reason. They're the number one organic oat brand in Ireland and the UK. So look, they had a good product from it, and you know, it's all part of their business. But look, I just think it's important to show these businesses and what can be done. You know, if our minds are, you know, if government put their minds to supporting tillage, look what can happen. Look, I just really enjoyed the visit. And from a renewables point of view, Stephen, I mean, it was exceptional.
Yeah, no, look, I mean, you have to give them credit where credit is deserved. Look, they have done and implemented and spent a lot of money on improving the energy efficiency and sustainability of the entire mill down there. So as Siobhan rightly said, whenever we were down there, you know, we got a tour around everything. They showed us everything, which was really fantastic, and they were so welcoming as well. Around about 70% of the company's total energy requirements are produced by themselves, and this is for a large mill with a large energy load. That's pretty impressive. I think the figure was around, since over the past decade, they saved around 70% of their CO2 emissions. So went from 3,000 tons of CO2 per annum down to 900 tons of CO2 per annum, which is pretty impressive. And they've done that, as I said, through implementing a series of measures. I think back in 2015, Siobhan, didn't they install a 500 kilowatt wind turbine? And that's generating a substantial amount of their electricity requirements. And then in 2020, they took a step further and installed rooftop solar PV, 130 kilowatt solar PV system on their stores there. But you know, those are the kind of the more modern investments by the company. But you know, if you go back further, even whenever the mill first started as such, like their only source of power was renewable, and it was from water. So it was, that's the reason why it was a mill. And even today, they're still using the water to generate electricity. They have a wind turbine connected to the mill race, and it's generating about 3% of the plants or the mill's electrical requirements, which again, like it all adds up. So it does. I think one of the most famous things, one of those interesting things to see from my point of view, was to see their biomass boiler, which of course we all know from the recent advert. So they're burning around 960 tons per annum of the husks from the oats after the dehulling process, and they're burning that to generate the heat through the boiler, which in turn generates the steam to cook the oats and also heats the building. By doing that, they're saving about 360,000 litres of diesel per year, and the ash is left over, spread on the land. So it's a really, really good circular economy model, and you know they've been doing this for quite a while, since the 1980s. So it's nothing, it's not new, and it's not because it's trendy or anything like that. They're just a really good example of a sustainable Irish company, and they're not finished yet either. By all accounts, they're going to go a step further. So they are across the operation over the coming year. So it was a really good visit, in fairness, Siobhan, wasn't it?
Super visit, and I think well worth a read. And I'd love if some of the policymakers would read it and just show what can come from tillage, and that land that those crops are coming from, you know, is a low emitting land. And you brought up the biomass boiler, and on that, the ad from the TV ad with the biomass boiler, you know, your man is, every time your man goes to talk, you can't hear him. And it's like it's a big secret as to how they make their porridge. But like, I mean, just thanks to the Flavins for letting us in. You know, John, James, Johnny and Annie, because it wasn't like the TV ad at all. They really showed us every part of the mill and every part of the business, and it was excellent. So I hope readers enjoy it this week.
Oats
is a cheap, relatively cheap crop to grow in terms of nitrogen requirement and in terms of pesticide requirement. So, you know, there's just so much value from it.
Yeah, and not to mention it grows bloody well in Ireland. So does it just suited to Ireland? So yeah, absolutely. Guys, look, we'll move on. Siobhan, in this week's in the news pages, you're writing about a new Soil Farmer of the Year award in the name of the late Philip Rick. Explain to us what this is.
Yeah, so Base Ireland have started a Soil Farmer of the Year award, and the award is in memory of Philip Reck, who died tragically in 2021 in March. And look, a lot of the people listening to the podcast will have known Philip and will have known his enthusiasm for the soil and for cover crops. And, you know, I think everybody, you know, if they were talking to Philip, they were asking him for advice. He was one of the people who you know, got people rolling their cover crops in the frost. And, you know, he had mixes of cover crops, and he had a reason for having those mixes. You know, he wanted to release different nutrients from the soil and all of that kind of thing. So you know, Philip was, you know, cover crops, balancing nutrients, he really wanted to improve his soil. And this award is in memory of Philip. So Base Ireland had a meeting down in Wexford on Monday, and after their meeting they presented the award. And the first winner of the award is Mark Armitage from County Tipperary. And Mark's a mixed farmer, and he was one of the first farmers in the country to have a no-till drill. And a lot of the Base people, as I understand it, would have demoed Mark's drill. So look, it's a nice thing in memory of Philip, and well done to Mark and his award as well.
But it's also, you know, it's also an award that is needed. So it is, you know, and I assume this isn't just for tillage. It's across the board, isn't it?
Oh yeah, Mark is a mixed farmer. Like, yeah, he's finishing cattle, and you know, he's into mob grazing and that kind of thing as well. So yeah, I think it's definitely needed. And you know, we have the Soil Farmer of the Year in the UK, and I think this will definitely be an award that, you know, it's going to encourage people to try and improve their soil. And I think there'll be competition among farmers to try and win this award. And really good to see it. And I see Mark in the photo, he has his spade. So the spade is the award. It's a good one.
Very good. Very good. No, good to see, and looking forward to seeing subsequent winners over the coming years. So look, guys, we're going to have a bit of a change of tact here. So you might have seen over the past week or so on social media, there's been a bit of a conversation, debate, if you will, on solar farms. Particularly solar farms on Irish farmland, and really we're talking about on tillage land. Irish grain growers were highlighting what they believe is to be an issue around solar farm development on tillage farms. I guess, to put it in context, you know, under the first renewable electricity support scheme auction, so that is the major flagship Irish government renewable electricity support mechanism, which is supposed to encourage large scale development of wind and solar farms, pretty much, and it did just that. Around 4,300 acres worth of solar farms have secured funding for 15 years by the government, and they're all through planning already. So they're just at various stages of construction. The second RES auction, so this is an auction based system. The first one was a couple of years ago. The second one is actually just after closing. So very soon, in the coming days, actually, we're going to have a good indication of the next generation of solar farms that are going to come from this auction. And to be honest, guys, it's probably going to be the same again. In fact, Airgrid, our electricity network operator, they threw out a figure of practically 10,000 acres of solar farms would be needed by 2030 in order to contribute to meeting our renewable electricity targets. So look, throwing it out there, Andy and Siobhan, what's your thoughts on this? Is solar farm development on tillage land an issue, or is it up to the farmer to make the decision for their own land?
Well, look, Stephen, we've always, and the journal would always be an advocate of people making the best decisions for their land, themselves, their families and their successors, and lots of the developments that are currently taking place are being done with that in mind. And, nobody can or should be able to take that from them. But, there are other things, like if you stand back from it, making energy from land, could you do it more easily from land that is either less productive or land that is, less well drained? The answer I would say is that if you go in to try and build infrastructure on land that's less well drained, it might not be a very pleasant experience. You can think of people envisaging the landslides that took place in the Northwest and even in the North Midlands in recent years. You don't want to go messing too much with what's there. But I do wonder, just as a philosophical ideal, if the placement of energy regions within counties or within provinces where you have wind farms built on hills as distinct from mountains that are controllable and negotiable, could we consider putting wind farms underneath them? Maybe it would mean having to not be able to allow access to area aid on some of them, but some of those areas probably are not accessing a lot of area aid one way or the other.
I mean, it's a fair question. So it is obviously from a developer's point of view. They're not in it for the good of their health. They are going to choose a location and try and target a location which makes the most economic sense for them to see the greatest return of investment. And by and large, that is the sunnier parts of the country, the southeast and the south. And indeed, there are developments in the Midlands as well. Yeah. I was talking to a good few SOAs about this over the week, and it really is, as far as I'm concerned, up to the farmer to make the decision which is best for them and their land.
Oh, I think it will be, Stephen, and I think it should be. But if you stop and take the criteria that they set out, which was more towards the east because there's more sun and things like that, which are real, there are also currently lots of windmill farms in those same regions, and I wonder, could they be targeted? Part of the infrastructure for electricity movement is already in existence. Now, there may very well be really good reasons why it wouldn't and shouldn't be there. And at the end of the day, anybody that will object to this as a form of land use are much more likely to be people who previously rented the land than the people who currently own and farm the land. If they're doing it for a reason that suits family long term. Whereas if you're losing land from tillage because it would be in the rental pool, I think people can and do take a different attitude to it in that situation.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Siobhan? Where do you stand in all this?
Look, I think you're right. I think, farmers have to make the decisions, the decision that's right for them. But I think we also have to look at, Our government, realizing that maybe the solar farms are going on to tillage farms because those farms aren't the most profitable. And why is that? And in the broader scheme of things, then we're putting in solar panels to reduce emissions. But tillage is our lowest emitting agricultural sector. So, you know, we're taking, while we're putting land into solar panels, it's the higher emitting land isn't going into the solar panels. So, you know, I just, there's dots to be joined up there. And, you know, I'm probably not putting that across very well. But
yeah, no, you are, because it's a convert, like, there's never a link made between that. So there isn't. And it's never a conversation or debate, which I've heard mentioned, but it probably is a good point. Again, it comes back probably, you know, from developers' point of view, tillage fields by and large are, you know, larger. They're, you know, in some cases, not flatter, like, but they're, you know, they mightn't just be as fractured or broken up maybe as some of the grassland farms. Now, that's a mass generalization, get that, but that's what they're looking at. So that might explain why they're going after tillage farms. And again, we don't have the figures just yet on how much tillage land versus grassland, you know, is going to solar, other than we know that it's happening and we know that it's thousands of acres.
But it'll be interesting to see how the thought process evolves, because the whole forestry planting conundrum that was there, well, it still is there, but that was certainly there 20-30 years ago. Forestry was grand as a concept until it started moving into agricultural land, and then all of a sudden there was people started jumping up and down because they could see it. And you know, it's only when people see these things that they'll begin to answer questions about where policy has taken them.
Yeah.
And I think they'll probably, we've all been talking about potential solar farms for years at this stage, but it's not until somebody is driving past one day that somebody will begin to ask the question, you know, could that be actually somewhere else?
Yeah, I mean, the key argument from grain growers or whoever was that, you know, they have the rooftop space, why can't it go there instead? And the answer is, it can go there and it is going to go there, but it's not going to be enough. And the return on investment, you know, from Ireland Inc. point of view, from rooftop solar versus, you know, rooftop solar, which might have a 50 kilowatt solar PV system versus a singular solar farm, which is 25 megawatt, you know, it's probably going to be cheaper and more efficient. And you're going to get the large volumes of electricity, you know, for export from the solar farm, as opposed to the rooftop enterprise. Like, and the reality is both are going to happen, you know, both need to happen in order to get to 2030. It's not a case of one or the other, as some might portray it to be, because both are going to happen. Then just the other point as well, and Andy, off the top of your head, you might have figures on this. You know, we haven't seen the food versus fuel debate in a better part of a decade now. Maybe energy crops might have been the last time it really fired up. I firmly think that we are on the cusp of seeing this again on a big way. And it's not just for solar, you know, it's for AD as well, because we are going to see purposely grown crops growing for AD, which obviously isn't for food. But if we look back far enough, Andy, that's nothing new. There, you know, we used to grow hundreds of thousands of acres worth of energy crops, didn't we?
Yeah, 1.2 million hectares to be precise on the island. And okay, that's a long time ago. It's back to famine times where the power was provided by horses, and the horses were fueled predominantly on oats and beans. And they were very, very important crops through that era. Of course, the era of mechanization caused significant reductions in the demand for those crops. And now, as we've said previously, oats is not exclusively, but it's certainly a significant food crop, whereas it was predominantly a feed crop some decades ago or a century plus ago. So, no, I think food versus fuel is something that is, it's never gone away and it probably will never go away. But there is only a potential to produce so much in the world. And with the world looking for to try and address carbon and energy and transport and heat and all the other basic requirements of man from a given resource, I think that we're probably going to have to see a little bit more scope in terms of how things will be done. Not just single crop use, but maybe multiple uses from a single crop, that you put it through one energy thing first and then use it as a feed. You know, there's just a different way of thinking that's needed, which you'll often find happen much faster in industrialized countries where industries get more quickly tuned in. But unfortunately, we don't have that many industries that are depending on grain for as a source of raw material, other than the feed sector. And the feed sector has been so comfortable up to now on imports. But, you know, maybe we will begin to see people talking about how we can generate alternatives with crops that generate two or three uses. That would be a very interesting thing to see going forward.
Absolutely. Okay, look, we'll move on from that, but I've no doubt that you'll be chatting about this again in the near future. So, guys, I got my hands on some figures from the SEAI, Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland, on their, they're the administrators of the support scheme for renewable heat. So this is our equivalent of the RHI in the north, except it is a lot more regulated and nowhere near as profitable, but still useful. So it's been launched, or sorry, it was launched in 2009. And so far, it saw a total of 84 businesses securing over 34 million in grant aid to switch from fossil fuels to renewable fuels to generate heat. So amongst those 84 successful businesses, there are around about 53 farmers. And between those 53 farmers, they've actually secured 21 million between them in the form of ongoing operational aid for 15 years. So what that means is that they're pretty much going to be paid for generating heat from renewable sources. I think it's quarterly payments, so, and it's a payment for every eligible unit of heat out to 15 years, as I said. Give you a breakdown here of what this is. There is 26 poultry farms. They secured 10.6 million between them over 15 years. 15 mushroom producers, they secured 5.8 million. 10 pig farms, they secured 3.5 million. And 2 horticultural producers, they secured 1.1 million. So look, it's no surprise. So it isn't that, you know, they're the users, the big users of heat, and it makes sense to switch over to biomass now. But I think, guys, the interesting thing is that this scheme, the support scheme for renewable heat, the total budget allocation to this scheme is 300 million. And, you know, there's only 34 million of it allocated so far. And there's no indication that it's going to close anytime soon. So I think for anyone who does have a bit of a heat requirement, it's probably worth looking into in a more serious way. And it's not just ongoing operational support either, as they call it. There's also kind of once-off grant aid for heat pumps and whatnot, up to 30%. So that includes air source heat pumps, ground source heat pumps, water source heat pumps, etc. But I will just mention that part of the reason why we're only seeing, you know, 53 successful farm applications or 84 in total is because of the red tape around the scheme. Like, I'll never forget just actually the day that everywhere went to lockdown for COVID. I was at an SSRH event further south, and I was chatting to growers who were in the process of switching over, and they said that the red tape that was involved with this scheme was just ridiculous. And it was proven to be a huge deterrent for them. And meeting some of them since, they said they just gave up on the scheme. So I think if anyone's listening from the SEA, it's probably worth having a re-look at some of the T's and C's and seeing what's required for the scheme, because there's a lot of money there. Farmers, businesses need that money. Oil price, gas price is through the roof. And I think biomass makes sense, and to a lesser extent, biogas for now. So look, moving on, Siobhan, it's all about carbon, and this week in the Farmers Journal you have a update on footprint farmers. What are they getting up to this week?
So footprint farmers, at the minute we're sampling for soil carbon, so we're trying to see how much carbon is in the soil, and then hopefully in a few years time come back and test it again and see if the carbon has increased. So exciting times this week on the page. So look, we go into a bit of detail on the page this week on how to go about it. And yeah, there's loads of carbon coverage in the paper this week and on the podcast. So we live streamed a lecture from Queen's University Belfast last night as well. So Professor John Gilliland was talking about. He's a farmer as well, and he was talking about his farm's journey to net zero. And he also had some other farmers on the webinar, and there was a farmer, Alistair McLeod, and he farms in Australia. And he has actually sold carbon credits to Microsoft. So you can watch back that webinar on the website, and there'll be some articles up from the webinar as well. So worth a read.
Yep, definitely. And as we know, and as we've mentioned before, Australia in particular, Australia and France, seem to be the world leaders in terms of actually monetizing soil carbon credits and showing us how it can be done. So definitely worth reading anything that comes from that. So Andy, grain markets, another week of movement, but not necessarily in the right direction for us.
Well, Stephen, I think it's depending on the time frame you use, a week of two halves, there was very significant movement up to Tuesday evening. And we're recording this on Wednesday. We would have seen prices in the past week, as in Tuesday to Tuesday, rise by about 30 euro a ton. You know, phenomenal increases happened in there, and they happened for two reasons. One, because the USDA World Agricultural Supply and Demand estimates indicated that both wheat and maize were going to be particularly tight going forward. Then at the weekend following that, so they injected a little bit of pace. During the following weekend then, India came out and said that it would not have any exports from now on until the end of the next crop, because it felt it wouldn't have the quantity to export because it had a really hot March that was impacting on wheat production. I gather since that it actually exported 500,000 tons to Egypt, but maybe we're not supposed to know that, but that's not it's not exactly a small amount, and it's certainly more than one lorry load. But it surprised me greatly that the announcement by India had such an impact in the market, because it would generally not be an exporter. Many of recent years it didn't have anything to export, or it didn't export because it has such a big population of its own. There's a huge internal demand, and it always wants to secure supply and stocks. And normally, it's only when stocks get very high that it chooses to export. A bit like China to some degree, when stocks get very high, it ceases to import for a while to use up the stocks, probably as much to prevent them from walking out of the door through infestations with this, that and the other, as to actually use them up. But anyway, whatever the reasons, I just thought that the announcement had a massively disproportionate effect on the market relative to India's importance in the export market, other than any loss in a tight market is significant. But I was expecting an adjustment to come in prices, and look, we'd seen futures prices get up to 433 a ton. Mind you, physical prices did not follow them. There was a very definite move in the early part of this week to prevent physical prices from following futures. So while futures hit 433, you know, the highest price that I got a handle on was 420. And the bulk of the quotes that I was reporting on were kind of between 12 and 415 per ton of dry wheat come harvest. And so you're developing kind of a 15 to 20 euro gap between futures and physicals. And because then barley has to compete head on with maize in the market, we were also seeing now a 15 to 20 euro gap emerging between wheat and maize, between wheat and barley. And that's to try and keep barley price at a level that makes it somewhat competitive with maize to enable it to be used. Because that's the great worry, that maize had become so much cheaper relatively that people were going to buy maize and ignore wheats and barleys as much as possible for the coming season. So the market was beginning to do what the market does. And that's up to today. Today's trading on Wednesday, as I look at the moment, prices have already dropped about 9 euro for December a ton. And I would have said I would have expected that. From all of these announcements, we tend to get massive overreactions in the market. And those overreactions tend to have a relatively quick counter adjustment. Now, I'm also looking at the amount of business that's being done on the futures today for next December. It's pretty high what's going on today. So I'm guessing what's going on there is there's been a fair amount of selling of people taking profits from the recent rises, because that's, again, is what the market does, in particular, what the investors in the markets do. So look, that's happening. It's happening across maize as well. And it's also happening on rape. I think I saw a second ago that rape's down about 24 euro yesterday's close. It closed last night, Tuesday night, at 8.61, currently trading at 8.37. So again, you know, I think people are always kind of hanging back to saying, oh, sure, it'll be more valuable tomorrow. I think you should never be afraid of taking a bit of a good price when it's in the market. It's always a sensible thing to do, no matter what day of the year that is.
Mm-hmm. Siobhan, do you have any indication on malt and barley prices?
Yeah, so last week, so Wednesday last week, the price was at, it finished at 4.46 on the Wednesday, so that brought the average to 4.1460. And just looking up now, the Sebastian price, so it's kind of the closest thing we can find to Planet. So the Fog Creel Sebastian price is at 4.70, so that would bring the average up to 4.2383, so nearly at 4.24.
Well, okay, and that's a big jump.
Yeah, to put a figure beside that, yesterday, I think it was yesterday, Glanbia offered 3.45 for green barley. So that's green feed barley at harvest. So that's a substantial premium that's likely for the malting people. And that's good news, of course.
Good news, because, you know, a lot of people have sold at the 2.50 and the 2.70. So, look, they'll be glad to see that going up the average.
Yeah, things tend to average up and average out at the end of the day. The other thing that I would say is that on the malting barley side, it doesn't have to fight off a competitor coming from the feed market side. So it makes the business safer for everybody that's involved when deals are done. There is certainly a growing worry in the merchant trade at the moment about, firstly, how can a harvest be financed where the value of the crop is almost double where it was last year? Will that finance be available to people? And secondly, if the inevitable happens, and it is inevitable, but we don't know when the inevitable will happen, that high prices decrease overall demand, and what was forecast as a deficit turns into a surplus, and then prices fall, who will own the grain when and if that happens, and what year will it happen in? And that's something that's very real for the market. You know, these extremely big price movements and volatility, somebody somewhere pays the piper on them, and nobody wants to be the one that's going to get caught. And that's why you're finding a resistance at the moment to allow physical prices to follow futures prices.
Okay, good stuff. Andy, finally, what are Met Aaron saying weather-wise for the week ahead?
Well, Stephen, just on the face of it, it's not a very pretty picture across the country, in that most days seem to have some rain in them for most parts of the country. Not a lot of rain in the main. I would say Monday of next week is the day that's currently forecast to have most rain, possibly with Friday coming also going to have a fair bit of rain in some areas. But, you know, as I look at the other days, it's kind of 1, 2 and 3 mils for other days across the country. That, to me, reflects the fact that there's showers passing. You could get hit and you could get missed. And, you know, it's the look of the draw in terms of where they're falling. I was just doing a very quick sum earlier this morning on rainfall levels to date relative to for the main tillage area. So if I was to take very quickly, Cork Airport's currently only on 25% call it, of its annual rainfall to date, which is kind of quite low relative to most other areas. And you stand back from those and ask, you know, when's the balance of the rain going to fall? Nearby Roches Point is on 25%. Many other areas are kind of on 30, 31. If I pick your area, Mallon, or take Mallon as being your area, Stephen, you're on 38 38.3%, or Mallon is on 38.3%, by far the highest amount to date that has fallen. Oh,
good harvest coming in, so Andy.
Well, Stephen, you'll have to hope. You'll have to hope for that. Most other parts of the country are kind of between 28% and 32%. So I'd be looking around the corner if I was on very low as to when it might fall. But most parts of the country are probably running, I would say, line ball or fractionally below line ball for the time of the year. I always worry at this time of the year that dry spells can quickly end up in wet harvests, and it must remain as part of what we have to think and worry about. Besides rainfall for the week, Stephen, wind speed's probably more conducive to spraying if you got a dry day. We're kind of seeing the bulk of the very little in the line of 20 kilometer an hour speeds anymore, kind of falling back to 13s, well, probably 10 to 18 is the bulk of the week. Winds sweeping mainly from the southwest, which means there'll be some breaking of the winds between the southwest or the westerly coast and where a lot of the spraying has to be done. Probably opportunities to spray if you can find opportunities that may not have showers. And temperatures in the main, warm but not necessarily high. Tomorrow probably is amongst the warmest days that's forecast for the week ahead. After that, it's going back to Sunday. Nighttime temperatures dropping from 10 on Thursday back to 6 for the middle of next week. So things probably not completely stable. It's nice to see growth rates slowing down a bit at times, as well as speeding up a bit at times. But nowhere are they getting out of control to the point of getting really rapid stem extension or anything like that that's going to give rise to massively increased lodging risk. So far, so good. Steady as she goes.
Okay, good stuff, Andy. Look, that's great. And yeah, look, there we're going to have to leave it for another week. And for me, I'm going to have to leave it for a lot longer, as anyone who doesn't know, this will be my last tillage podcast, as I'm heading on to new pastures. So after nearly 5 years working with the journal, it's time to move on. So look, not too many in this situation would have the opportunity to say a few words, so I'm certainly going to grab it. Look, working with the Farmers Journal, it's been great. So it has been hard work, big hours, but it's been great, and I think overall it's been a privilege to work with and represent the tillage industry over the years. Look, guys, we have a small industry, but we really do have the best of the best working on it. There's no shortage of talent. I've seen the best growers, I've seen the best in the trade, and it's really assuring and really good to see tillage finally getting the recognition that it deserves. Look, it's been great working with all of my colleagues, past and present, and look, to our editor, Justin McCarthy. Big thanks for always giving us the editorial flexibility and freedom to pursue what I thought we needed to pursue, whether it was for tillage or renewables, duck as part of this job. You know, Siobhan, me and you tested a heap of wildflower seeds, cost us hundreds of euros, but we did it anyway for blackgrass. I've tested imported feed for antibiotics before. I mean, for Christ's sake, I've even DNA tested potatoes before to see if they were Irish or not. And as it turns out, they weren't Irish. So we got a good story out of that. And look, any other employer, I think, would give you a funny look whenever you pitch these ideas to them, but not in here. Look, guys, I think most of all, it's been an absolute joy working with yourself, Andy, and Siobhan. The two of you are, look, you're a real asset to the tillage industry, and I don't think anybody apart from those who work with you really understand the lengths you go to represent the tillage industry, and the hours you put in and the sacrifices that you make, you know, and you are both technically brilliant. So look, I think after all of this, it's been great, and I think most of all, look, we're great friends off the back of it, and that's the sign of a really, really good team and an effective team at that. So guys, it's been an absolute pleasure, and look, thanks for everything.
But Stephen, before you go, we can't but let the opportunity pass from our side, Siobhan and myself, to say thanks to you for having served the industry and us and the Farmers Journal so diligently over your time with us. Hopefully it serves you well, and we can but wish you the very best of luck and hope that the pastures are greener that you're going to, and that it serves your career and your life well for the future. And we wish you, Siobhan and I, and also Justin and everybody else in the journal, We wish you the very best of luck in your career from here on. And who knows where our paths will cross again. So thank you, Stephen, also.
Yeah, no doubt. The industry is small, so we will be passing across probably fairly soon again. I'll just have a different colour of body warmer on this time. But look, guys,
you got a body warmer, did you?
Not yet now, but I'll definitely be putting in for one now. They'll have a tough job to get this Farmer's Journal one off me, that's for sure. So it is. Right, guys, we're well over time, so mea culpa on that. But look, we are going to conclude. So from Andy, Siobhan and myself, Stephen Robb, thank you all very much for listening. Stay safe, stay tillage farming.
We hope you enjoyed this Irish Farmers Journal podcast. You can find all our podcasts at farmersjournal.ie/podcast and on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.